Okay, we are going to talk about today, and I've talked about this a lot from time to time in the semester, but we're going to go a little bit more deeper into copyrights, and then in ownership of drawings. And we're going to, I didn't put in the Article 7, but from your B101 agreement, Article 7 is kind of like, I won't say it's the Magna Carta, the Holy Grail, whatever you want to say, but it is really good language for the architect with respect to ownership of drawings, copyrights, licenses, and everything else. So what I'll talk about will be referring to language in those provisions, 7.1, 2, 3, 3.1, and 4. And those are, even if you guys aren't working on a document that's a B101 or AAA document, and you're looking through it, if somebody like an owner gives you, here's my agreement or what something like that, go back to that agreement, go back to the B101 and pull out some of the language with respect to copyrights. So we're going to talk about copyrights and how you the ownership of the documents. AI and architecture, this is new. You guys will be the first class ever that I do a little bit of spiel on AI and architecture. I did a lecture on this, the legal ethics and issues on AI and architecture back in January to the St. Louis AIA, American Institute of Architects Conference. And I learned a lot. The cool thing is you guys will be the first generation, obviously the first generation, but really the first people going out and seeing how it's going to affect what you guys to do. So I'm going to cover a few things. A lot of it's in its infancy. It's something that I've started to concentrate and focus on to bring in yet another specialty into my career or whatever the advice I offer. But so we'll talk a little bit about stuff like that. And then the last thing, the starting your practice. As I said, I attached, if you guys got the attachment, there's a contract in there. I'm just going to briefly go through some of the elements in that contract so you know how to use it and what it's for. So that you can keep. You can give it to your when you get out there, if you eventually want to give it to your boss, you can, but like certainly keep it for, if you ever do architecture on your own, if you do anything on the side, it is fully loaded. There's every single provision you ever want in there, so a lot of that stuff you'll be removing out. If it's a smaller project and everything else, you can say, I don't need this, I don't need this, but it's got kind of everything you want, soup to nuts, which that's why I give it to you guys at the end of class. I've had, as you guys may or not know, but these lectures are kind of out there on the internet anyway for people to listen to it. And I'll have people from time to time send me emails and like, can you send me that agreement? I tell them all no. You guys are only my class gets this agreement. So anyway, so that's what we're going to do today. All right, let's talk about copyrights and drawings. So we're going to see this. This is the, I wonder if I can get part of these lights out. It's not very bright, is it? I don't know how to turn this one out. Hold on, let me give you a second. See if I can get one of these. I mean, unless you guys get... It's just kind of dim today. Let's see. Is that a little better? Okay. So, this is the U.S. Copyright Section 102A. Now, the architectural drawings... You're always able to copyright those forever. So, and this gives you just a general overview of what copyright protection is. It subsists in accordance with this title, 17 U.S.C. Section 102A. In an original work of authorship fixed in any tangible medium, now known or later developed, from which they can be perceived, reproduced, or otherwise communicated, either directly or with the aid of machine or devices. Now, this is a general overall view of what a copyright is, and we're gonna bring this back up when we start talking about AI. But the concept of copyrights has existed actually from the time of the Constitution. So patents and copyrights were developed back then because people recognized that intellectual property, and I'm going to go to the next slide here, is something that people can and should own. Let me get to the next one here. Intellectual property right. Now, intellectual property is exactly what it sounds like, which makes absolutely no sense. Real property, tangible real property, this chair is real property, tangible property. You can own this, you know what it is, you can hold on to it. Your car, your house, real property you stand on. All of that is property that you own. And everybody understands, I bought this chair, I own it. Intellectual property, as it sounds, is something that you can't physically own because it's all in your head. It's intellectually you own this. when you draw a drawing, write a book, write a song, everybody's going to be able to see that. Everybody's going to listen. They can actually go out and buy a record. They're going to own that, but they don't own the copyright. So while you own the physical CD or whatever else, you know, the download, and, you know, because now we don't even have the physical thing anymore. It's just on your computer or whatever. You can own that, but what you really own is actually a license. You don't own the copyright. The copyright as intellectual property is in your head. Same with patents and trademarks. And I'll give you a quick definition or explanation of the difference between the three. Those are the three kind of trident arms of intellectual property. So a patent is going to be, there's a method patent and then there's a functional patent. And patent is something that the elements, you don't have to worry about this for the exam, I just wanted to give you an example. When you patent something, it's going to be a piece of machinery or a computer program, or I did a lot of patent work when I first got out of law school. We used to do toys, we did medical instruments, dental instruments, all these different things, and it shows how these things function, what's going to happen. So if you write code, you can get a patent on what happens as a result of the code. You can also actually get a copyright on that code. Okay, so that's what a patent is. It's a functionality type thing or method, and you have to explain how it happens. They draw pictures, everything else. So when people create something, if they create and it violates that patent of how the function works or how the method works, that's going to be patent infringement. Second arm of that is trademark. Trademark is like the Nike swoosh or, you know, the Adidas logo or, you know, anything that you see that you recognize, that you recognize that that's something of a product. Mostly it's product in nature. There are, let's say it's 32 or 36 different categories of trademarks. You know, you could have the exact same name, but if it's in sports apparel versus mechanical or electrical devices, you can have the exact same name, and you can still have two different companies have the exact same name and the trademark and what it looks like, because people don't think that Nike is making electric watches or something like that. So there's some things about that. But a trademark is, again, going to be a visual thing that you can see and you recognize, and it harkens back to the company that produces those products or whatever. So what a copyright is, as that previous definition is, and it's expression of an original idea. So whether it's going to be by music, whether it's going to be by a painting, a drawing, a photograph, all these different types of things. So it's going to be more what I would put in the world of creative arts. And so you own the copyright in that original expression. And so when we get to architecture, it's how you draw your drawings. And so and that's, like I said, has existed forever, or not, for our intents and purposes, forever, respect to the Constitution. In 1990, though, there was a change to the architecture, to how architecture and architectural drawings and what could be copyrighted in the architectural world. It's actually called the Architectural Works of Copyright Act from 1990. It was a big change because in the past, the definition of what you had to do to get a copyright, to actually have, you've seen the C with a circle around it, that's the copyright. To actually get a copyright, you had to send a copy, a physical copy of your work, to the United States Copyright Office. And with an application you fill out at the time, it was like $10, and then they file it, and they take your work, and they would put it into, I don't know where, but there's lots of stuff in the Library of Congress. There's millions upon millions upon millions of things that were copyrighted that go into the Library of Congress. As things got on, as it moved forward, they realized you can't actually send everything in. So you just would have to file an application and fill it out. But how are you going to describe exactly what's in the drawings and everything else? Well, you would keep a copy of the drawings and things. But part, and we'll get there, part of in copyright infringement, and this is why it was such a sea change, and what happened is one of the elements that will come up on the board here of copyright infringement is you have to have access to the work to copyright it, to infringe, for there to be infringement. I'll explain that in a second. So what they did was, what happened, what was going on, and there was a number of lawsuits that occurred. Let's say and where it happened largely, where the push was going on, was in the residential housing world. And so I design a subdivision, I'm going to have, and I may have already said this before, I'm going to have the Georgian, the Colonial, and the Ranch, or whatever. And so I have 8 or 10 models. And so people come into my shop or to my office, and they say, well, we want this plot of land. Okay, pick one of these 5 or 10 different styles of houses, and we'll have our builder build it for you and everything else. And so people would build these houses, and then you'd have this beautiful Georgian-looking house or whatever it was. And the only thing that they saw was a little kind of like very high-level represented floor plan and an elevation. That was it. It was on a brochure. Somebody could take that brochure because it's not the actual drawings that were copyrighted. This is just a brochure. It's a representative of what's actually copyrighted, which are the construction documents to build the house. And they could take those drawings and they could copy that and they could build that Georgian in the next subdivision over. And before 1990, that was not considered copyright infringement because they never had access to the real drawings. That's number one. The second thing was happening is people were coming out for floor plans and stuff. And you could actually, if I wanted to, I could copy, not that there's anything unique or original expression about this room, but I could literally measure this room, floor to ceiling, wall to wall, door to door, figure out all that stuff, write that information down, and go home and draw that up, and it wouldn't be copyright infringement because, again, I didn't have access to the original drawings. So the Architectural Works Copyright Act said, nope. Now the expression can be the construction of the building. So the building before was never copyrightable. And you're actually not copywriting the building, but the building becomes the embodiment of that original expression. Maybe one of the things you could call would be a derivation. And so as a result of that, because there was all these lawsuits of people that were in the subdivision business getting their competitors were taking their really cool Georgian and Colonial and just mocking it up and, you know, two subdivisions over and building the exact same houses. So there was a number of those lawsuits permeated through, and then Congress came in and amended and created the Architectural Works Copyright Act. So that was a big sea change. It affected more than just architecture, but the big drive was architecture, so that's why it's called the Architectural Works Copyright of 1990. Major change as a result of how you guys can protect your stuff. And it was all correct, because you need it to protect. And one of the things that I may have said in class, but I will emphasize it over and over and over, your job is to draw buildings and draw parks and whatever your architectural project is, what's going to be. That's your lifeblood. That's how you make money. And you need to protect the ownership interest in your documents. Article 7 in the B101 is really good for that. You don't want to give up ownership. And I'll explain ownership versus licensing. But you want to make sure throughout your career, I own the drawings. Now, there are going to be times, like when I represent, and this is why, like, I'll just give you a little teeny little piece of what I would have talked about next week on RFPs. So I represent a lot of governmental entities. So when you're the government and people want to come work with you because they're normally large jobs, large projects, that RFP goes out, the request for proposal, so the architect submits a proposal and says, hey, we're really good, and here's our examples of doing these types of buildings, blah, blah, blah. And if you win that proposal, you become the architect for the project. Normally, in a governmental project, one of the requirements is that the architect must give up the ownership and the copyright. So there are times when you guys will have to. If you want to win the job, you have to give up the ownership. But not always. And so that's important for you guys, is try anything in any way to keep ownership of the drawings and your instruments of service. In fact, when I represent owners and they tell me they want to own the drawings, I ask them why. And they're like, well, you know, what happens if there's maintenance or whatever? And I'm like, I can get all that to you, but I still, not always, but by and large, sometimes the owners are like, no, I want ownership, especially my governmental clients. But I will look to the architect and say, I'm going to let you keep your ownership, but we're going to create a special kind of license for you that allows the owner, the building, the company that's going to own it, have like exclusive rights. And we did that with Haribo, and I'll explain when we get there. So there's all these different ways, but it's because I don't want the architect to give up their lifeblood. That's really important to me, being an architecture student way back when, and representing a lot of architects and engineers. There's ways that we can satisfy everybody. But for you guys, and for the rest of your career, hang on to your drawings. So, okay. The intellectual property right is federal law, so there's no state law in it. There's state laws on trademarks and everything else, but federal law is for copyrights, and that's because it came out through the Constitution. Only the specific expression of an idea can be copyright. It's the expression of an idea, not the idea. One of the more, I don't know, famous cases, but a big case when, that I remember reading about 100 years ago. We're on like Jurassic Park 11, you know, the most recent one with Scarlett Johansson or whatever. I just watched that the other night. Not nearly as good as I thought it might be. But anyway, the very first Jurassic Park, the book was written by an author named Michael Crichton. He was brilliant. He was actually a surgeon. Surgeon wrote a lot of these interesting novels and everything else while he practiced. I think he was a brain surgeon. In any event, he wrote the book, and it ultimately became a movie. The book had been out for a number of years, probably a decade or more when the movie was made, and then of course the movie made hundreds of millions. It was a big blockbuster. The very first time that they had the graphics that we see nowadays all the time. Nobody had ever done that. So it was the first time you actually looked on the screen and things like dinosaurs looked real. So it was this huge thing all over the world. Everybody was like, it was like the blockbuster of the year. And so this man filed a lawsuit for copyright infringement against Michael Crichton, and I think it's Universal Studios, saying, I have this idea. I have my book. My book is all about this. It's about a theme park. It's about this. It's about that and everything else. And the courts ruled against him because there were some things that were common, but not enough. And the idea that dinosaurs through cloning or whatever could live in our time and that there could be a harrowing issues and everything else, that idea you can't copyright. What you copyright is the expression of the idea. And as you start looking into the details of Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park and the gentleman, I don't remember the name of his book, the details of those books, how they expressed that idea were different enough that there was no infringement. And probably Universal Studios and Michael Crichton probably had a lot more money to battle him in court, but that's part of what it, and so you start looking at it. So it's important to remember the expression of the idea, not the idea. Next. Classifications of ownership. So there's different types of ownerships you're going to have. The default position for you guys are the party, in this case the architect, but anybody who creates that original expression of idea owns it. So unless there's something that changes that by writing changes the ownership, you are the owner of your drawings. So if you have a contract that's absolutely silent on ownership, you automatically own it. If you have a contract that starts trying to tweak that and what the licenses are and everything else, that's when you want to go back and look at the B101. Now, as I said, these are the instruments of service. So it's not just the drawings and specifications for the AIA documents. It's everything you create. And everything you create, including the coordination that are coming from your sub-consultants downstream, the electrical engineer, the structural engineer, the civil engineer, whatever they give you, they own their copyrights too. So when the electrical engineer gives you their electrical drawings and you incorporate into your architectural drawings, you do not own the copyright in those electrical drawings. And even though they're in your drawings, you don't own that. You have a license to use that. We'll talk about that in a second. Within your drawings. So, but ultimately, it's all the instruments of service. So as you as an architect think about what I own, I own this entire package. Even though some may be licensed to me from the subcontractor, for purposes of how the AIA documents are written, you own that copyright in all of that, the ownership. And it specifically says, you'll read it, it'll say that you own whatever you own and that your subconsultants talk about what they have ownership and they have given you license. It's very clear in there. The next element for classification of owners is what's called, sometimes called works for hire or works made for hire. It depends on which legalese you want to use. Works made for hire or works for hire are when you enter into an agreement. Let's say you are hired for a company as a consultant. You're not an employee of a company. You're just brought in for a specialty thing. Let's say they want you to come in and do some graphics. They want you to do renderings of one of their buildings that was recently built. And while you do architecture, it's also you freelance is doing images and stuff like that. If the contract you execute with them, if the written document for you to provide those services said that you were being retained for works made for hire, they own it, not you, from the very beginning. So works made for hire means the employer, in the sense of they've retained you, not as an employee, like a technical employee of the company, but the company that hires you as a consultant or a third party or whatever, that company owns the copyright from the outright. So it doesn't view the default position, it automatically goes to the owner or the company themselves. The reason why I'm trying to make this distinction between you as a consultant or a third party and an employee of a company is in most instances, unless you have a contract that says otherwise, if you work for a company, everything you create as an employee, a true employee, is owned by the company. So like the guy that invented the Post-it, so did you guys ever hear the story about how the Post-it note was invented? So think about little white pads of paper that you would tear the thing off, and the very top has that kind of red little plastic, kind of gummy plastic seal on the top that keeps the very top off of it. And then you tear off the piece of paper. Not, they're not Post-its, but they're just like that. So that was, the guy worked for 3M, and he was trying to create, he was a chemist, and he was trying to create a more efficient, cheaper topper for that, that little gummy red strip on top of the pads of paper, so they could make the product cheaper and more efficient. And while he was doing it, though, some of the glue or whatever you want to call it had too much viscosity. So it actually seeped down a little quarter inch into the pads of paper. And so when you would tear it off, there would still be that tacky material on it. And he was like, oh my God, this is really cool. And it was by accident that he made Post-it notes. Didn't get a dime for it because he worked for 3M. 3M owned the patent in it. And the copyright, and all the intellectual property. So that's when you work. So that's why I make a distinction for works made for hire as an outside third party, because they're not truly an employee of the company. And if you're brought in as a third party, your default position is you own the drawing. But if you're hired in a works made for hire context, they own the drawings. And then the last one is joint ownership. So like the biggest example I have of joint ownership is, so Steve Jobs started Apple with Wozniak and they did stuff. And then Jobs left and he created a company called Next. And he was making computers and stuff like that. And then they asked him to come back. They're like, we need you back here, Steve. And so Steve said, I'm coming back, but every single thing that I'm involved in, I get joint ownership. I'm not going to be an employee. I'm going to be the president of your company, which is still an employee, but I don't want to give up my stuff. This is my brilliance. And so he was joint owner with Apple and him in many, many, many of their pieces of intellectual property, which include copyrights and stuff like that. So you can have joint ownership with when you're working collaboratively with two architects. You can have joint ownership when you're writing a book together, when you're creating songs. If you think about music, there's all these collaborations between artists, and they have joint ownership in that. You take a band, like, you think of any band. Like, we all know that, contemporary Billie Eilish and her brother co-write that music. They are joint owners of that intellectual property, the copyright in that music. So there are other bands, like 100 years ago, Genesis was a band with Phil Collins, and there were really two main authors of the music and the lyrics, and that was the keyboardist and the guitarist. But everybody knew Phil Collins before there was Peter Gabriel. The way they had it is, the band Genesis owned the music, so it was joint ownership between everybody in the band. So instead of other bands, we'll just say, like, Springsteen, he owns all the music, and rarely is it with the E Street Band, so he owns it all. So it just all depends on how you want to do that. And any one of these, except for this default position, has to be modified in writing, because the default is, it's silent, you own it. Okay? All right, next. License to use the drawing. So we're going to talk about the licensing, as I said. So if you remember from the B101 in article, I think 7.2, but it says that the architect provides an, let me think of the language, give me a second here. Non-exclusive, that's what's coming to my brain. Non-exclusive license to use the drawings, because the architect owns the copyright, and I'm going to give you a license to use those. And then the language in the article goes further, and it's going to be used for constructing, modifying, maintenance, anything else. There's four or five different things that you can use those drawings for. That license is a grant to you to say, I still own it, for them to give you an opportunity to use this, and you're not violating my copyright. Every single piece of music you own, every single, if you ever download a movie, you pay for a movie on Apple or whatever, every single movie you own, that you have on your computer or stored in your whatever your audiovisual thing of choice. You do not own it. You have a license to use it. Or you have that music on your laptop or on your phone. You don't own anything. You just own a license. You have a licensed right. And that $12.99 you paid Apple for that music, or if you're working with, if you do Spotify and you're paying a monthly fee or whatever your music choice is, however you do it, those monthly fees is a license that's granted to you to use that. So it's a big deal in architecture, because you have to have somebody to have the right to be able to use your drawings, or any use of it would be an infringement. In fact, after the Architectural Works Copyright Act of 1990, constructing the building, the contractors building the building, one, they would be infringing because they're using the drawings that you own in to, if they didn't have the license, to build it, and the actual construction of it would also be an infringement of you as the architect's copyright if they didn't have the license. And so when you go back and read the Article 7 of B101, it says, I'm granting you the license to the owner of the project, and I'm giving you the authority to use these in the construction and allow people to transfer that right to the contractor, the subcontractor, the consultants, and everything else. So you can build the building without infringing on the copyright. As I said, it's a contractual right. If there's nothing in the document, and that goes back to this whole thing about if you get a contract from an owner that has silence on ownership of copyrights and ownership of drawings and everything else, technically, if you hand them the drawings and they build the building, they are infringing on your copyright because you haven't even granted a license. And so, while I say to you, if it's silent, you own it, I also say as the lawyer, you really want to include those provisions about licensing so you can define what their use is. If you're silent on what the use is and what that license is, and you grant it, there may be an implied right of a license, and then they can do whatever they want with it, and then you have to come back and fight about, well, what was the license for? Was it exclusive? Was it non-exclusive? Was it limited? Was it unlimited? All these things that come into play. So it needs to be written, this license, and you need to have that in your agreement, and then you can define exactly what those limitations are. It can be almost any conceivable combination of rights. So, exclusive or non-exclusive. For example, when we did the Haribo project, Haribo wanted to own the drawings. The architect was like, no way. And they went back and forth and back and forth. And I said, well, let's do this. The architect's going to own the copyright, but they are going to give you an exclusive license to use these drawings. And that means they can't give that license to anyone else. So, while Haribo doesn't own the drawings, they are the copyright. They don't own the copyright in the drawings because it's exclusive to them. That design, that feel of what their project is going to look like, for all intents and purposes, is theirs because it's exclusive. And if the architect gives that license of similar drawings to another party, Haribo could file an action against them and say, you violated the exclusivity of our licensing agreement. Most licenses are non-exclusive. Even when you're doing like a house or a condo or a hospital or everything, most of those are going to be non-exclusive because there's going to be so many elements that are being pulled in from all different pieces of architecture that the architects have done. I mean, you guys have been doing this long enough. I mean, I think architecture is like literally one of the greatest professions out there because of the creativity and the combination of left brain and right brain. But at the same time, we're reusing things all the time. My thesis with my velodrome and natatorium, the locker room for my natatorium was based on Nero's Golden House. I mean, a 2,000-year-old drawing ended up in my 1987 thesis. So we reuse things all the time. And so most of the time, not that Nero had any exclusive rights with his architect way back then, but most of the time things are going to be non-exclusive because we use things over and over. There are ways to get around, even if you have an exclusive license, how the architect can keep some stuff. I won't go into that detail, but that's one way you can have it, exclusive, non-exclusive. It could be worldwide. You could have a non-exclusive worldwide license or a non-exclusive U.S.-based license. So it could be non-exclusive for everybody to use it in the U.S., but maybe they can't use it anywhere outside of the U.S. So you can start talking about geographical places. That's another example. Third example is here, is limited or unlimited. It's limited, which is different than exclusive, limited for certain purposes. So it could be a non-exclusive license. Anybody could use it, but whoever uses it can only use it for purposes A, B, and C. So there's all different ways. There's more even than this, but there's all different ways to create this. Did you have a question?
What happens in the case where the figure and architect you design together and you get the constructor, you get the someone else, like another architect who has operated their files and development again, do you think that you copied their design, but you had no idea of something like that?
Got to wait a slide or two, and I'm going to do that answer. But the really quick answer is if they have a copyright in their work and you created their work, your work on your own and you never saw it, never anything else, you have a defense from infringement, even if they're the exact same thing. And I'll give you some examples of that when we get there. But yeah, that's a great question because we are pulling things from all different things we've seen. And maybe you didn't actually look at it, or maybe you don't remember looking at it, but it pops up in your drawings. You know, so is that an infringement? And there's some things about derivative works and things like that. We can talk about that and how to prove that. We will talk about that. But that's one of the questions, and that's where this intellectual property becomes really difficult and why it's... intellectual property lawyers, patent lawyers, they get paid a lot more than most lawyers because it's so heady. Because, look, if I have this chair, we know I own this real property. If this chair ends up in your house, I know you took my chair. I just have to prove that, you know, somewhere on here there's a piece of tape that says Hanahan on it or something. That's all I have to prove. That's real property, tangible. We can do that. We can show that you took it. Because infringement is effectively stealing, conversion. That's what infringement is. You're taking somebody else's original expression. But when you have, like your example there, where they have a building and a building, they look each other alike, is there really infringement? Did I take yours? So that's going to be part of the analysis. So, good question. Last one here, of elements of that are carved out. You can carve out certain things. Like, I can give you a license in this part, but not that part. So one of the things that I'll do also, let's say with Haribo, they had an exclusive license for the design of their facility. And I do this with a lot of people, like especially for homeowners, because these, like, I will have this language in the four big contracts that I'm working on right now for private residentials. They will all get an exclusive license because the billionaires don't want anybody to have anything that looks exactly like theirs. Even though, like, I don't know how many times you can make these really nice houses, they all kind of look the same. Not the same, but there's very similar products about it. If you go on some of these high-end architects websites, the people that are retained consistently by these high net worth individuals, and you click through their projects, like they has a similar feel and look and feel to it. So, how do you get an exclusive right as the owner? So I get my exact design and everything else. But then the architect's like, well, wait a minute. In my drawings for you, I've got a door detail, I've got a window detail, I've got a roofline detail. Like, things I use over and over and over and over. Like, how many ways can I draw up a door? I'm not talking about the full elevation where all the windows are placed and the, you know, the balances and how many gables and blah, blah, blah. I'm just talking about that detail, that section, that wall cut, that I don't want to have to give away. So what you do is I carve out in this license, I say it's an exclusive license, however, for standard elements, I, as the architect, retain and can use those whenever and however I want. So I've carved out, so the owner's like, yes, it's my house and I look at it, but if you design another house and use the exact same door, window detail, and all the standardized elements, that's not infringing on my house. Question.
And do you have to write, like, specifically what those are in the contract?
So you don't write every single item of what it is. The language actually talks about, I wish I'd put a clip on it, but maybe I'll do that for next year, sorry. But it talks about standard, it uses things like standardized details and repetitive elements that you use over and over. So you try to use it, and for the architect, you want that as general as possible. So you could say, even though it may be like this really cool window detail, it's not just how the section cut is, but maybe it's the way the oval looks and everything else, but maybe a signature item of yours. And it falls up on my house, and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. Well, but you are known for that. So you want to keep that whole thing. So that may be a standardized detail, but well, it's an original expression and everything else. You don't want that that to be limited to only that house. So you try for the architect to make that standardized detail language as large as possible. And then when the homeowner comes back and sees, you know, they have a house here in Chicago, they were traveling Connecticut, and they see this beautiful house that has these really cool windows that look just like theirs, and they sue the architect, we're going to say, this is not one of my standard details. And then you have to show that house to house to house I've done this. So you try to, for the architect, make it as broad as possible as standardized. The owner, you want to make it as tight, so that's going to be back and forth in the negotiation. And then at the end, if there is that lawsuit, it's going to be a judge or jury that has to decide whether there's somebody infringing or not.
So then by default, if you're like an architect and you get hired to make somebody call me and make it in your existing style or whatever, you can't like make another one to your existing style unless you like specify what are the elements you would like.
So by default, you can do whatever you want because there's nothing that talks about it. You're just giving them a non-exclusive license. And that's what I recommend. If you look at the AAA document, it says you are getting a non-exclusive license. I don't recommend for the architect, unless you have to change the language you find in the B101, because it's very favorable for the architect, as it should be. It's your lifeblood. If you start getting into a question where the owner is, I want ownership, I want so nobody else has these pieces, then you're like, okay, but I'm not going to give you ownership, period, the end. That's not how we do it. But I can give you a limited license that's exclusive to you for these things. And maybe there is a negotiation that comes into what is considered the original expression that the architect wants to keep. Maybe you have to go so far, depending on the negotiation, of how detailed and narrowly defined that is. But most of the time, you try to make that one paragraph as broad as possible with the architect, so then they can come back and show, I've done this over and over and over. So, okay, any questions on this? Or more questions? Oh, I got one more thing. Oh, and then termination of license. Two more things on this. So termination of license, there's also language in there that the license can terminate, meaning you never, like, so I'm the architect and you're the owner. If the license is terminated, you can't use that license at all. So why would it be terminated? Let's say you don't pay me, and you've defaulted on the contract, and you owe me money. I'm going to terminate your license. I gave you the example a long time ago where I represented a lighting manufacturer, and there was a reflective ceiling plan, and they wrote $450,000, and they didn't get paid. And so we wrote a cease and desist letter to them and said, you can't use this, and then we filed an action in court, went in for a temporary injunction. We shut it down, we got paid, and then we gave them the license back to use that. But you can use it. This is why it's so powerful, the copyright, is if they do, the owner does something that is not consistent with your agreement in the contract, you have the right to terminate that license. And they can't use it for building, they can't use it for maintenance, they can't use it for an addition, they can't use it for anything because that license is gone and you always still own the copyright. So any continued use of them by them, building the place or using it to figure out how they maintain something in the house, is a violation of the copyright and you can sue for infringement. So termination can happen that way. Now what happens is from the flip side though, let's say that the architect has defaulted. They can't make schedule. They defrauded you. They're charging you whatever. You have to fire the architect and you're halfway through the project. Well, the contract is now terminated, but you then are penalized if that license that you paid for, you as the owner, have fully paid up, you've played by all the rules of the contract and everything else. If you can't use those drawings to finish because that license is terminated when it's the architect's fault, then you as the owner are in dire straits. You have to hire a new architect, you have to shut down the project, you have to redesign the project. It's going to cost you hundreds of thousands, tens of millions, whatever the project is, to start over. So the other flip side of it is, from the architect keeping the license and terminating when the owner screws up, the owner defaults. If the architect defaults, the owner keeps the license for the completion of the project. So long as the owner is in good standing under the contract. You don't want, and I had a negotiation with an architect 2 weeks ago, and they were like, well, we want to keep this. And I'm like, you can't if you guys default. We get the license. Like, you can have your copyright, you own the drawings, you can do whatever you want after you guys go on your merry way, but if you guys default under us, I want to be able to finish the project. So we're still negotiating how that's going to come out. But that's fair. It's trying to be fair and equitable. If the architect has defaulted and they're gone, why should the owner have to pay double to start over? So, but licenses can be terminated. And the last one here, the owner's agreement to indemnify for non-project use. So remember that indemnifying concept is there's a third party that sues you, a third party's involved. So let's say we have a project and it's completed. We'll go for the easy part here. And it's not like somebody's terminated, we just finished phase one of the project and everything else. You always wanted to do phase two. You start to build phase two, but you don't hire the architect. Because phase two is literally a repeat of phase one. We've got one building, we're just going to set another set of foundations, we're going to build the exact same thing. Everything is perfect. So the license probably is only for phase one. It's for this project, capital P. You've defined what the project is. And the owner hasn't paid for the license for phase two. So maybe the architect is going to grumble and say, you don't have a license for this, I need to get paid for it. But even then, if the architect's not involved and something goes wrong in the project of phase two, but it's the first architect's drawings, that architect may get sued. And they're like, I wasn't around. I wasn't even running the project. I wasn't even there. You were using another architect. They missed it. I would have fixed this. That never would happen. So if you are non-project use, if you're using the drawings as the owner for non-project use, if something goes wrong, you need to defend architect number one if that lawsuit occurs against them. Because they're like, I didn't do anything. If you hired me, I would have taken a risk. You didn't hire me. So that's one thing that'll happen under all the language of the agreement. And that also is addressed in the B101. It's in Article 7.3.1. So, questions on this? Okay. Notice of registration of copyright. As I said, with notice, what it used to be is you used to have everything used to have that little C with a circle. That was notice. You don't have to have that anymore. Architectural works, I don't know if it was the 1990 Act or maybe it was, I think it was the 70, there was one in 76, 74, I can't remember. They got rid of the need you have to have the circle. It's automatically considered that you own the copyright in it. So it used to be a defense. They'd be like, I didn't know I was infringing. There was no copyright symbol on that. Well, that's gone now. But you still have to register it. You have to send in something to the United States Copyright Office and say, here's my work. You don't have to actually send the physical work anymore, but I want a copyright in this. I want to make sure I get a copyright. The reason why you do that, and you can actually do it at any time. Let's say we created a work today on April 24th, 2026. And we're starting to make money and we're selling products and everything else. And then in January of next year, somebody rips off our drawing or our poster or whatever it might be, and I've never registered it. I can send in a form to the United States Copyright Office and I can register it then. That's okay. And it'll backdate to when you created it. But the reason for registration is, and I'll get you in a second, the reason for registration is that it allows and opens up avenues for damages. Like there's statutory defenses and it shifts burdens and everything else. We're on the legal side. But there's a legal reason why you want to do that. You don't have to file a copyright infringement action initially, but to be able to have the proofs of it, you want to register. Question?
You have given your information right now, but if you were to take it to the office,
yeah.
But it's not built, it's just existence of the drawing,
and I take
it to the office
copyrighted. Yes. As long as your drawing is an original expression of idea, whatever that might be, you can get a copyright in it. Question back there.
Is there any sort of, I don't know if there was school has some ownership over your work.
So I was going to say that, but I don't know UIC's rules, and so there may be within the university charter or whatever, when you sign your papers to come to school here, there may be a joint ownership, there may be full ownership, I don't know that, but conceptually, if they don't and the work is your work, then you own it and you can get a copyright in it. But like if you think about it, my guess is that there is certain rights that the university has. Let's say, I'm assuming that there are certain portfolios and other advertisements that the university puts out, and they publish students' work in that. And you guys don't get a call and say, hey, can we put this in? And you don't get any revenue if it generates, if they're selling any books or stuff, right? So there's some type of ownership rights that they have in that. It may be that they own it all. I don't know what UIC is, but that just is, that's what could happen. But conceptually, like you said, if you create something and it just plans and doesn't get built, that's what only used to be copyrightable before. Back there.
scenario possible where, let's say I graduate and then I'm a high school professor, college at the time, that is way too similar to something I did work in the school.
Yes.
Would it be worth it for me to talk to them about that?
So it would always be worth it for you to talk to them. If the professor takes a design that you created, you know, and it's recreated, whether it's through a publication or ultimately embodied into a piece of construction, something that's been built, you always want to talk to them. The question is do you want to talk to them alone first? Do you want to talk to them with an attorney? And then what will you get out of that? And we're about to get to damages. We're going to talk about what kind of damages you can recover. And so the thing that I tell every person that calls me, is what are your options for recovery here? What are your damages? If it's just because you got your name, you got your thing published, maybe you say, hey, can we call and have the newspaper or the magazine in their next month's publication say, oh, and by the way, this was a joint work with, or you get authorship and you get credit. I actually worked on something like that where there was an infringement by, I don't think it was a professor, I can't remember what it was, but the author had done it as a student and didn't get credit. And so we actually wrote a letter. In this case, we didn't bother to go to the person that had submitted it. We went straight to the publication. We wrote a letter and said, this was my client's drawings. And there was no money that this client was going to recover. They just wanted to get recognition. And then they printed it was electronic, so they it came out right away, and they gave him credit for that. And they probably had some conversations with the person that submitted it. I don't know. We never had to deal with that. But yeah, if it's your work, you should take credit for it. You should get credit for it. Not take credit, get credit. So, good questions. Okay, elements of infringement. So how do we have an infringement? This was back to your question. Infringement must be intentional. There's no such thing as actual infringement. Oh, geez, I didn't realize that I was looking at these drawings and by accident mine looks at it. You know you're taking something out. You may not know it's copyrighted. You may not know that it's something special or this or that, but you have seen something and you are reproducing it because you are copying it. That's an intentionality, and that's something you have to prove, intentionality. This one, the second one, though, is probably one of the most difficult things. If I want to prove infringement, I have to prove that they had access to the copyrighted work. And that's part of the elements of why the Architectural Works Copyright Act 1990 came in, because they would say, I never saw your drawings, and that's all that's copyrighted. But we would see in their discovery photographs of the buildings and drawings and measurements and everything else, and they're like, but your building isn't copyrighted. Your brochure isn't copyrighted. What's copyrighted is your drawings, and I never had access. And so that's why they changed the law. Question?
That access, because considering now, like, everything with the internet, does that extend to, like, you know, like, browser history, like, if they were to...
Yes. Yeah, and so that's one of the things that will happen. That's why, when back to your question, is it worth it to go talk to somebody about it? And why intellectual property attorneys probably get paid so much money? Intellectual property litigation is prohibitively expensive, because you have to start looking through all this information, all this documentation, all the history and everything else. And there's a lot of times proving access is really hard, because if you're not there and you can't see that they're there, sometimes you have to prove access by, like, you have to almost say there is absolutely no way they could have copied this unless they had access. But the example I always use, and I know it's completely overblown, but if you get two monkeys in two different rooms that you learn to teach them how to type, and they both type out the same book at the same time, but they're stuck in these two rooms, and it's the exact same book in the exact same language, neither of them are infringing on each other. Because they didn't have access to it, and they both were creating an original piece of work. Now, of course, that would never happen, but part of the reality is when you start to try to prove infringement, proving access can be difficult, because they can say, oh, I never saw that, or whatever. So you have to start putting the pieces together. There's such complexity and technicality in this, there's no way they didn't have access. They can say they never saw it, you know, and that's where this part of this access issue fell apart for the Jurassic Park case. Because even though the book was out there and Michael Crichton's book was out there, they couldn't prove that Michael Crichton had ever seen this other author's book. And then because they said, well, they had to have seen it because the storyline is so similar, and they said, but we can't prove that, they tried to show examples of where the two books were so much alike that they could have not done it without access, and they didn't meet that test. They couldn't have met the objective standard of how close they really were. So that's the next element. And is it an original expression of the work? Is your drawing that you may have copyright in it, the copyright could be invalidated because they may be able to prove that what you got a copyright in, I saw it here and here and here and here and here by all these different people and everything else, and it wasn't really an original expression of an idea. It wasn't an original expression. So sometimes you may sue somebody for infringement, and the result of that is you lose your copyright because yours wasn't an original infringement, original expression of the work. Question? So that's a really good question. As-built drawing. So what you have, so let's say you go in, you're renovating somebody's an old church, and the drawing was created, whenever it was created, back in the 70s. They built the church in the 70s. And the architect's gone, and the owner, original owner of the church is gone, and everything else. And so you're hired to come in, and you need to do renovations to that church. Maybe just the interior, but maybe you're doing an addition and everything else, and you go through and you do as-builts. You create the as-builts. Are those as-builts an infringement of the original drawings? And the question is what are you actually using? Are you creating an original expression? No, you're not creating copyrightable work. Are you, in fact, infringing their drawings because you're renovating and you're getting paid for that? Potentially. But then the entity that would have to sue you would have to be there. And so maybe you can ultimately work out a license to do that. Maybe that entity does still exist. Maybe they're just bringing somebody in, a new architect, to do that. And so one of the things that happens when I do work with people on renovations of buildings is the first thing I do is I go to the owner. A lot of times it's somebody that I represent, but often I represent the architect into it. And I say, do you have the original drawings? So we get the original drawings because it helps you, because then you got to create as-builts after that. And then I say, and then I will look to them and I say, have you talked to the previous architect? And have to have a discussion about that. In fact, for mine, I think I talked about it. I did a little 100 square foot addition in the back of my house to change a closet into a bigger mudroom. And we had the original drawings. And I contacted the architect and I got permission for the other architect to use it. Now this was over the phone. I didn't get anything in writing because it was just literally cutting out a wall and stuff. But so you as a prudency, if you're in that situation as the architect, hired by the owner, whatever, it's worth it to have that discussion. Could there be an infringement action against you if you create the as-builts from now measuring the drawings? Potentially. The likelihood of it, minimal, and then the likelihood of going to a lawsuit because of the cost of being in that lawsuit against you being so prohibitive, probably not. So, but it's technically there could be infringement. Question.
If I'm an architect and I want to steal the designs for the Guggenheim, I just want to do the Guggenheim, but I don't have access to the drawings. But I go in there and I walk the building and I make it as close as I possibly can. Like that is my intention, and it's clear what that's my intention.
Yep.
But I never had access to the drawing. Is that still not considered a copyright infringement?
No, because of the Architectural Works Copyright Act, the building, once it's constructed, becomes the embodiment of the original drawings, which are copyrighted. It's called a derivative work.
Okay.
But that document itself then is an embodiment of the original copyright, and it has the copyright. So that's the whole point, is people, when I was talking about these subdivisions, people were coming in and measuring and taking from the physical building and then recreating them elsewhere, and they said, I never saw those drawings, and that was an infringement because the building was an embodiment of the original drawing. That's exactly the reason for the act in 1990. So, I think there's anything else. What else we got here? Oh, so damages and remedies. So now we have some of the infringement. We got an infringement. And this goes to the question of whether you want to bring a claim, whether you want to make a phone call to this professor, or whether you just want to contact the newspaper or the publication that forgot to put your name on there. How do you want to do that? What are your damages? What's the injury that you have? Is it worth it? So one damage you could have, you get a court injunction. That's what we did with the reflective ceiling plan. We went into court. We didn't ask for money from the court because the value of what we were owed was owed by the party that was doing it. We could have, if we'd gotten a permanent injunction, and then we could have gotten money where the court ordered them to pay us, But we didn't have to go that far. We got an injunction. We said, you cannot use these drawings. We stopped the project. Actually, stopping the project was going to cost the owner much more money because they had to shut everything down. All the electricians were gone. Everybody that was working on those areas, because it was the entire building of the reflective ceiling plans of all the building. Everything had to be shut down. HVAC, everything. So we shut the project down. The cost per day was so prohibitive that they wrote us a check within 2 weeks of us filing that claim because we got the temporary injunction. So you can stop them from using the drawings or whatever's copyrighted. You can't put that movie up. You can't play the music. There was Ice-T had a big one with Ice Ice Baby, but I think Ricky Martin, when he had that La Vida La Voca, whatever that song was, I think there was a big copyright infringement of that. Probably the biggest one that and again, this is going back a number of years, Marvin Gaye, after he died, heard it through the grapevine and other songs. There was an infringement of people because it was starting back in the late 80s and into the 90s, probably mid 80s and into the early 90s. That's when people started doing sampling and they would take music and stuff and dump it into their songs. And it's much more common now, so it's handled a lot differently. But they were taking pieces from Marvin Gaye's music, and there was a big lawsuit against the people that had taken, and there were actually chords and part of the music. They didn't actually, they sampled some of it, but they also brought in some of the underlying chords. And so the song had very similar melodies of Marvin Gaye's, but it wasn't the exact same. The words were different. And so the lawsuit was about whether what they took was an infringement. And so they went first for an injunction to stop them selling the music, but they weren't necessarily prevailed on that. They got a temporary injunction, but they weren't going to be sure of what they do. So then it went to a full court case, and it went to jury, and Marvin Gaye's estate ultimately won on that. I don't remember what the song or the company was that was infringing it, but there was monetary damages because their claim, the estate's claim was, this entity is making money off of my estate, Marvin Gaye's work, and so they are profiting off of another person's work. So they started to try through injunction and then move forward. So, question.
With music for like architecture, how is it handled in different states? Like the laws of different states and like nationally, does that change or is it just a national?
So that's a great question. Earlier on the slide, there was it said it's a federal law. So it's all applied. So when you file an action for copyright infringement, you file it in federal court. You don't file it in your local state court. So you're not going to go to Cook County for a copyright infringement action. Now, certain jurisdictions and states may file their own copyright laws, but you normally go to federal court because that is the overriding and it's consistent. Certain 5th District versus 4th District versus 9th District, there's some flexibility in how that is because certain areas of the country are more conservative and liberal, and so the judges may do different things. But ultimately, the decisions are based on the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and the federal court system. So you try to get as close to a consistency datum of the rulings on what happens for infringement. So these two different types of injunctions I have here. You get the preliminary injunction, which is the very first, and you go in there for an emergency. It's an emergency order. You rush to the courts, you try to get it right away, and you say, stop, 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 you know? And so that's what we did for the reflective ceiling plan. And what you have to prove that you have a likelihood of success. It's the likelihood that you're going to succeed on this case if we went to the full trial on its merits. So you have to give enough to the court for this emergency ruling to say, hey, if I had time to do all the discovery, take all the depositions, and do all the stuff, we're probably still going to win. You don't have to prove 100% you're going to win, but the likelihood of a success. So it's a balancing scale that the judge looks. You have to show there's irreparable harm. My client was owed $450,000. We said the license was stopped. We had irreparable harm. Until they paid us, they were using it, and they couldn't do it. There's a balance of equities between and hardships. Is it equitable versus hardship? Is it equitable that they can continue to, in this case, use our drawings? Is that fair? It wasn't equitable. So the court said, okay, that's the third element you passed. And the last one, is it in the public interest? So you have to prove all four elements to get that emergency ruling. And if it's in the public interest, and here we're saying, yes, because if you can let us use, and this was actually Sometimes it's harder, but this one was relatively easy. It's like, if you let this contractor and this owner take our drawings and not pay us and use them, then that means that everybody can do that. It's chaos, you know? So you can't. So the public interest is that the owner of the copyright, that lifeblood, keeps that ownership and can protect it. So this one's not as difficult in copyright infringement, but you have to show all four of those to get a temporary injunction. And then from there, you can get it. And then things, a lot of times after that temporary injunction, the preliminary injunction, things settle. We got settled. We got paid in 2 weeks, and then we didn't have to go. Then we dismissed the case and went merrily on our way. A lot of times, that's enough to resolve the case. And so even back to your question there, you could have gone to the professor, and maybe he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. You go in for a temporary preliminary injunction, and if you prevail on that, then all of a sudden he's going to be like, oh, well, maybe I don't want to go through the big giant lawsuit. They don't want to spend the money. So you work something out. I think I've told you guys the story of the client that I got called that had they designed the house with the circular. They looked like all these intersecting circles, and then he saw it on a magazine cover, and the architect that was on the magazine cover won an award for that. And I got called, and I told him, like, we can sue them, but I'm going to tell you, quote, right out of the box, you're going to have to give me a retainer of $50,000 because we're going to eat that up in filing this claim and within the first month of this case because it's so expensive for this type of infringement. And he didn't want to go that route, so we wrote a very nasty cease and desist letter to the publication. That was a much cheaper route. And they got in touch with the architect that won the award. They rescinded the award. There were some discussions. We were able to show some stuff, but we didn't have to get into the big things. But the big lawsuit, and that's why it will often settle between preliminary injunction and permanent injunction, the cost to go through an intellectual property lawsuit, patents, trademarks, or copyrights, can be really expensive. So a lot of people settle after that preliminary injunction. Question? So it's a great question. Ultimately your question is, this seems like a burden. It seems like it's overburdensome and almost unfair to the party who didn't do anything other than create a work and somebody ripped them off, somebody stole it from them. And it seems like that's a difficult thing. It doesn't seem fair. You're exactly right. And unfortunately, that's litigation as a whole, across the board. You're going to find that's just like I find it. Maybe you won't because I'm a lawyer, so I have people calling me all the time about construction issues. But I will say, especially in the homeowner world, because I do a lot of homeowner work, so I have a name up there, but I get a lot of calls from people that are much, much smaller houses. And I never dissuade them from filing a claim per se, but I always talk to them about the realities of the cost. And there is a much smaller percentage of people, because I'm like, especially when you're dealing with your home, I'm like, you're going to be dealing with this for the next 2 or 3 years. Every time you walk into that room, you're going to think about this problem because it hasn't been resolved. You're going to be mad. You have to write and pay me bills. You may not get everything you want when you're at the end. It may be more expensive than the value of your claim. Do you really want to go through all this? Some people they do, and then we do, and we go. Some people we don't. And then at the end, I'm a lawyer, it's my profession, but sometimes at the end, especially in stuff like this, where it can be difficult to claim and prevail, the only party that wins are the lawyers. It's not right, it's not fair, but there are other times when on principle and on reality, and you have to fight it. So I'll give you an example of a company that, this is more in the trademark world, but Harley-Davidson. So we all are familiar with the Harley-Davidson motorcycle. We all probably, if you think about it, maybe not all of us, but if you think about it really hard and you can picture in your mind, you can kind of see that Harley-Davidson in the grill and what that logo looks like. So Harley-Davidson, when I first learned about this is when I was in law school and I learned about this, I had a TV in my house. It was one of those, this is back when people used VCRs. You guys know what a VCR is? Okay, so I had a TV. It was something, I don't know where my parents got it, but I had it in law school and then I had it after I graduated. And it was all in one. It was a TV, it was a 19-inch color TV, and the VCR was built in. It was a Harley-Davidson. That TV was made by Harley-Davidson. It actually wasn't. It was made by some Japanese thing. But Harley-Davidson, during the 80s, said, oh my God, we can make so much money by licensing and branding everywhere. And like, so everything, you would see Harley Davidson, everything, including a TV. Like, it was so cool because I'd be like, I got a Harley, but it's just a TV. And I'm like, it was something that I, for pride, and then like, but it was giant because it was the old style TV, so I eventually got rid of it. But somewhere in, I think that those, it was mostly in the 70s and into the 80s where they were doing all this licensing. They were licensing everything, and the mark, the trademark, became so diluted. People didn't care about it, and so Harley Davidson started canceling all these licenses that with all these other people to get the strength of their mark back. And if you watch the sales and the notoriety and the respect of Harley Davidson, after that happened, it went up. And so there are reasons that you want to get injunctions against people and their damages and stuff. So it was a big deal that they were recapturing what they owned. And so by principle, if people infringed on them, they would go after them. They would say, I don't care if I'm going to lose money and spend more money with lawyers. I need to protect this brand. And there are a lot of companies still to this day that because the brand and the brand name is so important to them, they will go to the mat to not have a situation where it's diluted. So that may be, and they'll know that. They're like, we don't care how much it costs. Some of my partners have clients that are like that. I wish I had clients like that, where the client's like, I don't care how much it costs, but my intellectual property partners have those clients, and they're like, I don't care. We're fighting this. We're not going to let anybody have our mark. So, okay, so the permanent injunction, you can get money damages. So money damages, it's like, you know, you can either prove that you could have sold this more. There's two ways you get money damages. If you're still selling the product and an infringer comes out and sells this other product that's infringing on you and your sales go down, you can get money for the loss of sales. You can prove that loss of revenue after, and you have to show charts and timelines. Here's this product came out that undercut us by $4 and ours was 12 and theirs was 8, and you can show this steep decline because it was, you know, a 30% discount. And then you can also say, and all the money they got and any profitability they got, we get that too. So that's a monetary claim that you can make. That's one. Lost profits, that would be talking about lost profits, actual damages, that's how much I wasn't able to sell. And then the last one here for monetary damages are statutory damages. Sometimes you have no real dollar value. Your work that your professor used and put in the magazine and got their name and you didn't have a name, did you lose any money? Could you prove that had your name been on it that you could have won some other project, and you know, because it's on your resume, all this other stuff? Maybe, but it's really difficult. So you don't really have tangible monetary damages. And if you remember going back to the anatomy of a lawsuit, one of the elements in both tort and contract is you have to prove damages. You have to show that you lost something. And so the legislature, when they were making the Copyright Act, recognized that some of these, like, I can have a real simple damage with this chair. This chair cost me $24.95 at, you know, Bed Bath & Beyond or wherever I got it on thing. So I can say, you took this, you owe me $24.95. I can make that. Intellectual property, it's in your head. What is the value? Did I lose something because my name wasn't published? So the legislature said, we're going to create, in the statute, statutory damages. So you can apply, and I got to go back and look, but it used to be between $0 and $250,000. It was capped at $250,000. And then it's up to the judge and or jury to award to say, even though they can't show any physical dollars, we're still going to give them $100,000. Now, for many years, there had been no cases where anybody was awarded the maximum statutory damages. For many, many years, nobody got up to $250,000. I know that's been eclipsed now, and it may be higher than. I haven't gone back to see if they've modified the statute. But at least you can, if you don't have any true, actual lost profits, you can say, I get something. It might be just a dollar, but you can get statutory damages for that. Questions? Anything on this? All right. Exceptions to infringement. So how do we have where there's somebody actually copied and it's an exception? There's something called the fair use doctrine. And this applies, I know, in the education world, and it applies to non-for-profit. So you can use any architect's drawings and stick it in your drawings and not be infringement. It's part of your education. It's an educational use. The not-for-profit is not as clear, but you can sometimes use somebody else's if you're a not-for-profit organization, because they are not making any money off of it. Now, the architect, depending on what their architect's doing, if they're profiting from it, but if it's free services and the architect are giving to the not-for-profit, that's a fair use doctrine. Those are exceptions to infringement. It could be the exact same drawing, but it's okay. And like I said, there was no copyright that still existed under New York's Golden House, but I copied it. Period. The end. And I said that in my presentation, in my thesis. I'm like, this is Nero's Golden House. And then I put up a picture of Nero's floor plan, and I said, this is how I... And part of my discussion was how I incorporated into how a locker room worked. So it made sense that I wasn't just blatantly copying, but I was blatantly copying it, but how it worked and why it made sense for this. But you can do that for any contemporary architect right now, for anything you guys do, because it's fair use in the educational world. Sometimes it's the nature of the copyrighted work. So is this something that, when we were talking about, is it an original expression? Could it be not that it's not really infringement because that nature of the copyrighted work wasn't really an original expression idea? Question right there.
The exceptions to infringement, are these in law or do they need to be written in?
These are by court law and case law and everything else. These do not have to be written into it. So when you get sued for infringement, you're going to be like, did I have a fair use? Was this something that's copyrightable? Your lawyer's going to tell you about how you can get out of it potentially. So, next one here is the amount and substantiality of the work used in proportion to the copyrighted work as a whole. What the hell does that mean? Well, let's go back to the Jurassic Park. Yes, there was an idea about an island, and there was dinosaurs on that island, and terror happened, and blah, 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 people died. But there wasn't enough of what was being copied from one to the other to say that it was a copy of that original expression. And that's a balancing test. That's a very subjective analysis. And one judge or jury may say, yes, it was a copyright, and the other one may not. That was what the Marvin Gaye trial was all about, was there enough of the work? And so part of the proofs was showing and playing the music to the jury. They took the actual infringing work and they split it up. You know, like you've seen probably on TV where they can break down music and they have like the audio line is one and the tenor stuff and like all the different music can be split by the electronic machines. And so they played the music by Marvin Gaye and then they played the music, the song, and they peeled away elements of the song until they got to, this is the underlying chord, and lo and behold, it sounded just like Marvin Gaye's. And so they were saying the basis, the foundation of the song was enough, substantially enough of the work to show that it was an infringement. But if they showed the other side, it was just a little piece, I only riffed a little bit, not enough, then it wasn't an infringement. So that's a subjective kind of case-by-case analysis. Also, the effect of the potential market of the copyright work. Going back to your issue, like if they took your drawings, was that affecting the market? There could be analysis. The other side could argue, like, you're not even entitled to statutory damages because it didn't affect the market. It was just one tiny little publication that has, like, you know, 250 people that observe it and stuff. So while it may have been infringement, it's you haven't shown enough of that damage, enough of the effect on the potential market to show that you have infringed for a lawsuit to be settled or granted in your favor. So, couple more exceptions. Parody political culture illustrations for clarity. So, like, you can have somebody parody you, like, and all the stuff that goes on, like, this is the wild, wild west right now with AI. Because they're taking people's, if you think about what happened, and again, whether you're into sports or not, you go back 5 years, 8 years, when they started to get into this name, image, and likeness thing with universities and their athletes getting paid. And I'm all in favor of athletes getting paid because universities were making all this money off of their name, image, and likeness. We don't need to go into how it's kind of also changed the entire sport, but there was rights for that. Well, now, is it really, if you have, like, an AI, is that, and we're going to talk about it in a second because we're going to get to AI, is that image created by AI, the name, image, and likeness of the individual, is it taking, let's say that the individual had something, some kind of piece that they did, and they copyrighted that work that, you know, I don't even know what, like, that just pops in my head. completely bizarre, random, but the Bears in the 1985, when they won the Super Bowl, they had the Super Bowl shuffle. There was a really lame video they came out, and they're all doing that. That's a piece of work. That's a piece of art. And somebody has a copyright in that art. If somebody made an AI of that, parodying it, would it be an infringement? If they just copied it, but they parodied it? No, it may not be. In AI, you're not even sure. But there's a lot of things. But you can parody, you can do political stuff, but all those are exceptions. Culture illustrations for clarity while you're writing something, you can always do that. You want to cite it in a footnote, but anything where you quote a piece of like a poem or things like that, you're not infringing on the copyright if you're putting it in and you put it in quote or clarity. Like I said, you want to note it, but that's not infringement. You don't have to call up the author of this poem and say, can I use this in my dissertation or wherever you're going to write it up. You just have to make sure you recognize the authorship in it. So, an infringement, an example, another exception to copyright infringement, more like a defense, I would say, is the expiration of copyright. So copyrights don't last forever. So copyrights last, if it's by an individual author, like the author, plus 70 years. So after they die, it's for 70 more years. So we all know Wicked that was just out in the movies, but when Wicked was released on Broadway, and The Wiz that came out on Broadway, that was after the author of Wizard of Oz had died plus 70 years, and they could do whatever they want. Most recently, you guys may or may not have known that. I have not seen any of them, but they have a very violent horror Winnie the Pooh movie. And the Pooh Bear is not a nice bear. That's because the copyright finally expired. The author had been dead for 70 years. And so they have this, came out, I don't know, it was last summer or the summer before. But it's supposedly like this wicked Pooh Bear thing because the copyright expired, so you can do whatever you want with it. So, and there's lots of stuff, the things that people just change. Like, back there.
Do you know anything about, like, the drama of Disney? Like, I've heard they're extending this,
Yes. So the question is, how do they? What can they do to extend your copyright? And you can create other elements of that derivative work, so then you can show that that is a copyrightable work in that. But like Steamboat Willie, the argument of the original Steamboat Willie that was originally drawn, which doesn't look like our Mickey Mouse today, that so anybody could do that. But then, what Disney has also done is Disney has created that Mickey Mouse is a mark, is a trademark. The trademarks stay together as long as you pay the bill, as long as you keep filing and renewing your mark in that area. So it's not a copyright now, it's just a trademark in it, and everybody, if you see the Mickey Mouse ears, you see those ears, you know Disney. Like that, those ears, everybody knows Disney. When you just see a silhouette of that, you know they're Disney. You see those ears and on the hats and everything else. So there are ways creatively, but it's not ad infinitum, it's not forever that you can always do that, but you have to have some creative, very good lawyers to be able to do that. And then you have to be like Harley Davidson, and Disney's another company, and Apple, and some of these giant corporations. They are like pit bulls to protect their mark. And if you start infringing on them, and you have Disney Corporation worth billions of dollars coming after you, do you really want to go and fight them and the cost and everything else? I mean, the legal fees are... So you step out. You're just like, okay, here, pay me a couple $100,000 and I'll give it back to you or whatever. So there's lots of ways that people protect their marks other than just creating a little tweak of Mickey or marking them or something like that. So, but yeah, think about the movies like Cinderella and some of these, all these movies that are out now. Disney has made those movies. Disney is like all the live action. They've made those stories based on the original cartoon that was back in the 40s or 50s to keep that story alive so people can't make the movies themselves. So that's another way that they can extend the life in some ways of a derivative of the original copyright. So that's the original, that's the individual. Now, if it's a company, and this is also, so Disney, depending on whether it was Walt owned it, or the company owned it, or Steve Jobs and Apple, if the corporation or company owns it, it doesn't have to be a corporation, it could be a partnership, it could be sole proprietorship, but if it's not the individual that owns it, or if the owner's anonymous, if you don't even know who wrote the book, or if the copyright is owned by an entity because it was a work made for hire, so we talked about that, those are the types where that length of your copyright is 95 years from publication or 120 years in total. So you're going to say maybe you put the ownership of the copyright into the company and you extend it further. So those are other ways you can protect your rights for a certain further extension. I don't believe anybody but the estate of Winnie the Pooh's author, I can't remember who the author is, owned it. So when that expired, it expired, and now we have violent Pooh Bears. So. Excuse me? They could have, yeah. And I don't know if there's a mark on Winnie or not. I don't know if there's a mark on Winnie the Pooh or not. And I don't even actually know like what marks there are that exist for Disney. Like I said, that's one way they could have done it. I don't know for sure. They may or may not. But there are different ways that you can create a mark and how you do that and the just things of likelihood of confusion and knowledge of people. There's all these elements that the trademark office looks at. Before they even grant you the mark. So, I did that in the very early part of my career. I did copyrights and trademark work only before I did architecture stuff. Okay, anything on copyrights? So we're going to do a little bit on AI and architecture here. As I said, this is brand new. So we're going to go way, way up. All this stuff is at like 100,000, maybe get down to 50,000 feet. But the thought about AI, just as in general, certain professions, AI is going to be groundbreaking and monumental. Architecture is going to be one of them. There's so many areas in architecture that AI will be beneficial and detrimental. Detrimental in everybody talking about the loss of jobs. And I think nobody really knows what's going to happen with that. I don't have an opinion one way or the other. There was an article that came out, I want to say in January, by a programmer, very sophisticated programmer. He released this long thing. It was on lots of social media things. And his position was that he had been, his job, and again, I don't even remember which company he worked for, but he worked for one of the large companies like a Google or an Intel or something like that on their AI stuff. And he was helping write their generative AI and how it would teach itself and the speed in which the AI itself became out of date, and then they would release a new version, and then they release a new version. And what ended up happening was they then started looking to the AI to help write its own code. And that went on for quite some time. And again, I'm highly summarizing this, but it's out there. I'll try to remember the name of the guy and send out an email for it. But it really wasn't doing what it needed. Like, it wasn't smart enough. And when he released this in January or February, or at least when I saw it, January or February, his position was that now the AI is writing smart enough code that their next generations, instead of taking months, they're taking weeks to create, and they are now starting to do it. And they focused on, the other part of the article is they focused on one area of the one industry sector about coding and how it creates and learned about coding. And then once they get that down, then they're going to apply it to different professions. So there is this thing about, well, it's going to come over and it's going to be smarter or what have you than the people. I don't think so. I'm old and everything else. But I still think there's going to be plenty of use for people out there. It's just, can you and will you become proficient in it or what you need to do? And do you guys do anything with AI here at all? That's cool. That's good. A little bit there, but yes. But it's good. You need, honest to God, like that's the one thing that, there's like three things that I say for this class. Protect your copyright, have a contract, and make sure you do things in writing. And now this is just added because I did this lecture, like I said, in January, as I started looking at it, kind of opening up my eyes and doors. I was like, wow. Start to learn what AI can do for you and where you can be proficient in it. So that's what we're going to talk a little bit here. So the first thing here, we have design automation and generative design. So we're going to have design automation is going to be really, really excellent for the architectural world because the speed in which you can create design after design after design is going to be so much better. Now, it's going to be part about it's like how you, like prompts and everything else. But one of the areas, design automation, and then generative design, like, Like, when you guys are designing something, when you guys are in class, you know, you make a plan or however you guys are doing whatever the product you're going to be, the project you're going to ultimately do, and then you work on it, and then you draw it again, and then your professor comes in, and you work on it a little bit more, and then you draw it again, and you refine it and everything else. That's generative design, just over and over and over. That's just tradition, that's just thing. But now we have generative AI. Generative AI does that boom, boom, boom. That can be done so much faster. I had a contract provision that I needed to get done, and it would have taken me probably about an hour of looking at some old examples and thinking about it and drafting and everything else. And I, our firm has, Perkins Coie is our firm, so we have PC chat, Perkins Coie chat, and one of our clients is Microsoft, so it's a specific one that we got right from Microsoft. It's this closed source book for just ours in Perkins Coie. When I asked him, I gave him a little prompt. Write me hazardous materials, blah, 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 like two or three sentences. Spit out like three paragraphs immediately. I was done. It was great. Like that would have taken me an hour. It took me 5 minutes. So there's those things that will happen in design as well. When you want to, you're designing a house or whatever, you can say, oh, I like this plan, but maybe make the living room bigger or maybe extend the hallways there or whatever. Boom, it's out. So that generative concept that you guys are going through all the time and what you're doing now, so much faster. So that's going to be really good for your work product, for being able to do more at once. Project management and scheduling. So scheduling is really important in a, you know, time is money in a project. So scheduling of whose trades are going to be there, how you project manage it, who's going to be when, where, how the project moves along. Right now we use different types of software. There's a lot of paperwork, a lot of hands-on stuff, which is great, and that's not going to go away, but this will help things with organizational. It would be great, the AI on working with projects that are being built. Rendering and visualizations. It's funny because I saw this word in a contract the other day, and I'm like, they will provide 2 3D drawings and 3 visualizations of those. And I'm like, visualizations of those? So I called my clients, I'm like, what's a visualization of those? I go, is that like a rendering? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, well, why don't we just use the word rendering? But now visualizations is coming in because it's how the AI, so a rendering may be just like a sketch or whatever, like, you know, from like a floor plan, or it could be an elevation or whatever. But a visualization may now take that and expand it 3D, and you can walk through the house, and it becomes this whole experience. So that's another place the AI will be able to take your floor plan, and they will take your elevations, and they'll be able to go and look at the actual sites, because you can show them on Google Maps where the house is going to be, and the next thing you know, poof, within 10 minutes of the thing spinning and spinning, you're going to have this house sitting there with the pool and the car parked in front and the birds flying through, and then you show your client, you're like, do you want to go inside? And you walk inside and the doors open and it's your floor plan and it's decorated all the walls and stuff. That would take you guys weeks to draw if you had to do it on CAD, but now AI is like, boom. It's incredible. So, and then different tools for different phases of the services. So your early concepts and sketches, you're going to have some types of tools. And the tools will be created. The people that are going to be coding them, the people that are creating them, and maybe you're going to be doing that within your firm. You're going to have a specific tool within your AI that the package, your software you're using, that will be for concept and early design. It's very rough. It's quick rendering so you can do over and over and over, and you can show a bunch of things to the client. And then when you get into schematic development, now it gets to be more detailed, because now the client is seeing where the volumes are or whatever. And then you get into production and construction documents. And so the phases that you're going to go through in the B101, the same 3 phases, from SD to DD to CD, will be there. But now the AI is going to be tailored specifically to those phases. One of the questions that came up when I was doing this presentation was, what do we do with respect to that within our client? How do we communicate that? And I'm like, you're going to need to tell them in the contracts. And so we're now starting to write language in the contracts that inform the owner that the drawings are going to be rendered by AI, and they have to authorize and say that that's okay, because the cost and the speed and the time and everything else. So there's lots of stuff that are now coming in, because maybe you don't want a client, but maybe the client's like, I don't want AI, I don't trust it, don't do that. You just never know. Did you have a question?
Yeah, One question I have about the use of AI in architecture, and in pretty much anywhere, but generative, a lot of generative AI models are trained on data that they don't necessarily have the copyright for, or they like do not legally access. But because the model is, it's like there's no way to parse out like legally obtained images versus illegally obtained images. When you, in your practice, if you were to use generative AI to help create a render, for example, and in the image that is generated, there happens to be some copyrighted material, are you liable? Like, what do you know if there's any precedent for cases like that at this point?
So those cases are all pending, but there is nothing specific. That was one of the things I was looking at. There are a couple cases in my lecture. I can even send you around the whole slide power package of that if you guys want to look at it. I don't have it recorded. I could call the AA and everything else. But there are some cases that are just starting to touch on that. I'm going to touch a little bit about how it's being dealt with. But people don't know yet. Like, because if it's so, what you're talking about is the difference between open source and closed source. So open source AI is that anything in the internet is available for anybody and they can do whatever they want. And so if you publish your drawings, even though they may be copyrighted drawings, they're on a website, that's open source. Now, is that an infringement because you tell the AI in your prompt, draw me a drawing, create me a drawing of blah, 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 you write your prompt and everything else, you have no idea that it's out there, and you don't really have access to it, but does your computer have access to it because it's looking at the world, and then poof, it comes back and it's got a floor plan. Part of that floor plan was a creative, original expression of an idea by an architect. Have you infringed? Did you have access? Was it intentional? Is it an original expression idea? Did the AI, what it created, if it's only a piece of it, is it enough? All those questions, nobody knows the answers to yet. It's going to be really hard to figure out. So, part of this year, so we have here, this is a quote from a guy, one of the senior designers at Gensler. AI accelerates the cognitive loop, enabling us to explore more within the same time and shift repetitive work toward high-value decision-making. So these are some of the benefits. A couple more slides, we're going to talk more about your stuff. Think about it this way. So a senior designer is one type of AI tool that can create multiple designs with a client to revive it and end product faster. That's a benefit. So when you're talking to your client about using AI and generative AI and generative for their drawings, this is what it does. And then you can reverse engineer that once the decisions are made because you have all these different pieces and it's just models. But now you reverse engineer to make your construction documents. So that's one thing you can do and the AI can help with that. Younger designers will task that using the AI to help take that end product and reverse engineer it and work toward the more detailed design process. So how we use those is I'm the senior designer and I'm just showing like the big pictures, which is what often happens, the big picture person and the senior designer, and then the younger designers are taking that and making that into more SD, DD, and then ultimately CDs. And then the use of the AI with the design team and with the clients is beneficial for accelerating design decisions, but it's not necessarily defined and not final construction renderings. It may not be the best for the final construction documents because of what you're saying. If I'm taking this design development, this DD drawings that I have, and I want to now make the construction documents, and I say, AI, create this building for me, the floor plans, the sections, and the elevations, are there going to be hallucinations in there? Are there going to be things that they took from the open source that actually put the right building? Will the building fall down because the AI created it? And unless you look at it over a fine-tooth comb, were those construction documents complete? Have you violated your standard of care? We don't even know what the standard of care is right now for AI for an ordinary architect because there's not enough ordinary architects using AI. So that's a big question out there, because when you ultimately do those construction documents of what's going to be built, you have to stand by that those drawings and those documents, drawings and specifications are to the standard of care. And does the AI have that standard? Like, that's something we don't know yet. There hasn't been enough training of that. So those are some things to think about. So this is areas where I think you guys can try to benefit from yourself. If you have training in prompt writing, is the question you ask. And how you ask that question to the AI can dramatically affect the outcome. Interestingly enough, too, and I don't know if it's on this slide. No, it's going to be coming up on another slide. But I'll say this out loud, or say now. You can take, and this is where the question of what's copyrightable in AI, you can say the same prompt. I've done this. I was for my hockey team. There was a couple guys that I wanted to do a parody of them at St. Patrick's Day, because I had a picture of them standing around waiting for them to be picked up in the lobby of the ice rink, and they're both holding cans of beer because it's 11 o'clock, it's barely hockey. And so I wanted them to make them look like leprechauns. So I told the AI with the same prompt to shrink them down and put in leprechauns outfit and change the beers they were handing into size. And they did one. And then I said the exact same prompt, and they gave me a different picture. And I said the exact same prompt. I did it four times. Every single one was a completely different picture. Same prompt. So what's copyrightable? If the exact same instructions to the computer, the AI, results in four different results. And some of them they had like, you know, the foot was wrong and all the weird stuff that happens when you're doing AI images and everything else. Is that really copyrightable? What's copyrightable about that? You don't know. I mean, I don't know how many of you guys have ever played around with creating images and stuff, but try that with just one prompt to do it over and over. You'll get different images each time. It's kind of wild. So training in prompt writing, especially in the architecture world, how to talk to the computer will be huge for you guys. That's one place where that prompt writing doesn't, well, I can't say it doesn't, because that's not what they're talking about in the coding, that now the AI can talk to the AI. So will that change? But right now it's not in the architecture world. But so become good and proficient in prompt writing. The text to image generating skills, that's part of the prompt writing. Can you write that story to create what the image looks like when you're change that? So not only the original prompt, but then like you just how you're just what you see, let's say you see an elevation, how you describe what's that elevation, what you want to change. The text to image generating skills. There's a value in the prompt and the way you speak, communicate with the AI. So these are all kind of all together. How do you communicate back and forth between them? Certain generative AIs, and if you have an open or closed source loop with your software, will learn to talk to you differently. And the same AI will talk to you differently than they'll talk to your other colleague. Same computer program, but it's because of the way you're communicating and chatting. So when you get into your firms and your in-house system, there's two different sites. There's an open source and closed source system. Open source is what your question was about there, because everything in the world's out there. There's no guardrails, no safety guards, or anything like that. It's general public source knowledge. In the legal profession, lawyers are getting tagged, I won't say daily, but certainly weekly and monthly, for filing briefs that were written by AI, and in those briefs are case cited of cases that don't exist, or arguments of the law that are the complete wrong argument because the AI was pulling so many things, and the AI is kind of like, certainly open source, they're kind of like a little kid. They want to give you an answer. They want to satisfy you. So they will create stuff out of thin air. That's called hallucinations. I actually use an earlier version of PC Chat because we've had our own iterations of it, and I was writing an outline for another speech that I was giving, and I asked them to give me articles on the topic that I had, and it cited six articles, and four of them were for articles that existed outside in the real world, and two of them were articles written by my partners. So I'm like, oh, Bob, this is really cool. Like, it's going to be on my system, and I can go and I can read the article, and I can call up my partner and take a look at it. They didn't exist. My own software, my own firm, created the titles and the thought process of the articles by my partners that were never written. So when I went to find the article, it didn't exist. And then the AI came back and said, sorry, I can't find that. What can I help you with? And they talked to me about it. I'm like, don't lie to me. I mean, that was my own firm. So I couldn't use those four. At least they gave me some real articles that I could read, and two of them were good, and the other ones weren't. But that happens in open source, and we're closing our sources in what we do. And so closed source is protected, but sometimes it's not. Protected is meaning that people can't come and dump things in. But closed source normally is within your own universe of people that are working on it, whether it's your firm, whether it's an industry. You can have a closed source for dentists, but nobody else can go into it. You have to be like part of the ADA or whatever it might be. So there's different ways you can do that. What's important about it for like an architectural firm is you will have those standardized drawings. You will have certain images, certain ways you guys do things that will be part of your firm, and that will become ultimately part of your firm's look and feel, their brand, what they are. You have that closed source AI that's working with you. So when the images that are created, they feel like your firm. Now, the negative of that is it becomes too homogenized. Oh my God, everything we're doing looks over and over and over. We all look like the same thing. Can't we do something different? So those are good and bad. But those are some things you want to think about. And when you're working and thinking about how do I help my firm or how do I help my career, and looking at AI with some of these things. Now I want to bring this back because this is the same thing we had up earlier. But here we talk about it's an original work of authorship fixed in a tangible medium or expression. So we have my two buddies, my two friends that are leprechauns drinking beer in the lobby of the ice rink. And I thought it was kind of funny. It was my idea. Let's just take Mike and Rob, and we're going to put them into that. That was my original expression. And they pulled a whole bunch of stuff, and they put them in these little leprechaun costumes, and I thought that was a cool original expression idea. Tangible medium was on this monitor, and it was directly with the aid of machine or device. I used a machine, I used a device, I used AI. That should be copyrightable, but it's not. Right now, the U.S. Copyright Office says those images created by AI, as we sit today, cannot be copyrighted. That's the current position. And the reason why is because I gave the exact same... I did this, by the way, because I had heard this lecture about... I had a lecture and I'd already presented on this, and I'd done some reading about how prompts can be... They don't really do anything, necessarily, or they're not necessarily created in a copyrighted image. So that's why I did the same prompt four times. And I have four different sets of leprechauns in my buddies. It was pretty funny on our WhatsApp chat line when I was sending those out. But because if the prompt, which is a written expression that I have telling the computer to do something, creates four different things, each one of those can't be copyrightable because it's from the same original expression idea. So maybe the prompts can be, and the Copyright Office now says, your prompts can be copyrighted, but the images themselves cannot. Question.
So what if you created a greater work based on an image? Like if you were to say, hey, Claude, give me like five different examples of something that look like this and this, and then you're like, great, and then you use that one to create like your actual design, can that be?
So that's kind of taking her question and taking it one step further. So you've gone to the open source or wherever the information comes, and Claude gives you a building with a floor plan and sections and elevations, and elements of that have infringed on somebody's real copyright. And then you take that, but we know that the image that you've created can't be copyrighted itself. And now you take this image, and then you create your own, and you draw it out, and you take that, and you're taking elements from it, you're looking at it, you're copying and pasting and stuff like that, and you've now created your work. So it's not Claude's work, it's not necessarily, it's you've created it. Is it a derivative of the original copyright? Arguably yes, because you have taken elements of theirs, and if it's substantial enough, could be an infringement, but the law doesn't say yet whether that Claude image is an infringement, and so your use of the Claude image is a derivative of the Claude image, which we don't know if that's an infringement yet or not, so is your infringement? So the answer to that question is, I have no idea what will happen. It's all in its infancy. Like I said, there's a couple cases that are floating out there right now that are not on architecture. They're looking at other types of original expressions of work and everything else. But there's some stuff out there, but we don't really know yet. That's where it's the Wild West. Question?
So if you were to create, let's say, a render... I'll use the example that we did in our studio last year where we created renders and the people in the images were generated using imagery. So the images themselves were like originally authored, but there were AI images like collaged.
Yes.
Is that something that could potentially be copyrighted, or would you not be able to copyright the entire image because it has AI materials inside of it?
So you're talking about what you created.
Yes.
So you created it using a software that wasn't AI that's part of it, but then elements were AI'd into it, like the images of the people.
Yes.
I would say that you should be able, again, this is just spitballing it. I did intellectual property law 100 years ago. I'm starting to learn more about it because this is so important to me because it's part of what I'm doing in my area of law. So I don't know the answers to it, but I think there's an argument that can be made that because you created, even though you're using a software program to create the original, the basis of the imagery, the drawing, and you inputted AI stuff, that by your thought process of dropping those in, that the overall piece could be copyrightable. You couldn't necessarily copyright the individuals, but the conglomeration of that, because you didn't, the basis of it, how it was originally created, was not created originally from AI pulling everything together. There was a software program that you use like normal. And if you didn't dump other AI images in, and you just had the software product, but you used the software and you created your own renderings, those would be copyrightable, because by the aid of machine or device, that's okay. You can use CAD, all your CAD drawings. I mean, that's just a less sophisticated than, you know, a 3D rendering or anything else like that. You're using that. If you take a look at the company that does Fortnite. I don't remember the what's the company? I'm sorry, say again. Yeah, Epic Games, yeah. I'm terrible that I'm forgetting that, because I actually did some of the, they were building their world headquarters down in North Carolina, and I was doing the preliminary contracts for them like 2 years ago, and now it's on stall. But so we, it's one of our clients, Epic, and they have their software. It has a specific name, this engineering, this software that drives all their machinery. And people license it from them and everything else. Everything that comes out of that software, it's not AI, but it's almost there, is copyrightable. So they can, you know, so the images, the people, the Fortnite look and all that other stuff, they can get copyrights on that. Because it's use of aid and machine. But if you now use the AI to create everything, that's the question, and that's where it's unknown at this point. So
would that, do you think come down to a question of percentages, how much of one work is original versus use of AI?
I don't know. I would love to give you an answer, but it's so new that I don't know. Like I said, the Copyright Office still is trying to figure this out, because they say, you know, can we give a copyright on that product? No, we can't. The end product, that's the imagery created, is not copyrightable, but are the prompts. So, what the Copyright Office says is, oh, you had a question, I'm sorry.
Yeah, have there been any cases or cases of the Claude or ChatGPT or whatever these companies trying to claim ownership of the things that are created and them wanting to have the intellectual property rights, or does that go against their models or whatever? If I was to write a movie script using this, could they then go and be oh, we wrote that movie script and we want rights to it?
Well, the answer is, are there any cases? Don't know. Will there any cases? We live in America, yes. Sometimes there's these companies that are creating, that create these AIs, will try to claim ownership on stuff. It will happen. I don't know what and what passion, but mostly what's happening is when you pay, I use ChatGPT that I can play around with at home, because I do stuff like making my hockey buddies and leprechauns and stuff like that, and I pay, I don't know, $14.95 a month or whatever to use that. That's a licensing fee. So I'm licensed to use that program, and the argument is I own my own product, but I can't get a copyright in it. So, you know, you own stuff, but what do you own? We don't really know yet. That's part of it. But part of it helps answer where the Copyright Office sits. Is it says, Copyright Office says, human authorship is required. They have to have some human into it. So that's where, now, like I said, this article that came out where, in the coding world, where this author, this coder who had been doing this, he's been in the business for 10 years of AI and coding, said, in the last month or two, I've become obsolete, because now the coding can talk to the coding, the AI can talk to it. We're not there, because they concentrated only on the coding industry and the architecture, but right now, in general art, creative, architectural, and copyrights, and any type of work, to get a copyright, they have to have human authorship is required. And so whether the work was basically one of human authorship or computer or other devices merely being assisted the instruments, so you have to look to see, is the computer assisting you, or is the computer creating? And that's when they say, when the computer creates the image of my friends in the leprechaun, all I did was talk to it, and they created. I wasn't involved in the creation of that. That's why human intervention wasn't. They created the prompt, but not the image. And so whether the traditional elements of authorship in the work, literary, artistic, or otherwise, elements and stuff, were actually conceived and executed by human but by machine. Like, what were they done? Who did what? So, again, it's going back to this, and that's why when I say this prompt writing, like, I also saw there was a lot of flaws in how these drawings. So when I finally picked the best outfits they had of the four, then I had to key. I had like half a dozen more prompts to like, okay, move this, change that. His feet are too big, so you have to like give it more instruction because it's just it's like a child. You have to tell him what to do. So I was helping out with the creative input to get the final product. Ultimately, still I didn't design it, but my prompt writing was what was helpful to get it better. And so that's where you come into seeing like what ultimately is going to be copyrighted. I still think my friends, when they came out, that image still wouldn't have been copyrightable, but I was moving closer because I was giving it more instruction. Samples for AI-generated materials may contain sufficient human authorship. So the human has selected, arranged AI-generated materials in a sufficiently creative way, but protection would not exist. That should be would, instead of world. Not extend outside the compilation. So this kind of goes to your question. So now you are taking AI-generated images and you are compiling them in a very specific way. Was that basis, was the original? Can you refine and refine and refine where you can show that the final image that you did with AI was driven by you? Is that sufficient? Those questions, so these are guidelines. We don't have case law on this. This is just the copyright guidelines. Or the human modifies AI-generated materials in an original creative way. So I take this stuff and I cut and paste, which goes again. I've taken these people that AI has generated and I plop them into my other rendering and make it look like it's a real scene. So there's different things you can do, but again, right now these are guidelines. We don't have cases on any of those. Or if they are, there's not. There's some pending, but they haven't had any answers yet. So, and then we got a couple more slides, and then I'm going to just for 2 seconds talk about the other paper or the contract they gave you. So prompts alone are not sufficient based on today's technology to create a copyright work. So just your simple prompts, like I said, you have to do over and over and over. So prompts do not adequately determine expressive elements or control because it's just this pulling from everything. Now if you say, I want you to take this and this and this and this and this, and you get this really tight prompt, maybe, but we don't even know yet. But that's what it's talking about here. The same prompt can generate entirely different outputs. What I say, my hockey players, my buddies. The prompt itself may be copyrightable. However, that still results in different creations with the same prompt. So, I got a copyright of my leprechaun ice buddy, hockey buddies. I can copyright in that instruction. But if somebody takes that exact instruction and feeds it to a computer and gets a cheaper image and sells that image and makes money on that image they sold, have they infringed on my prompt? Because was the prompt specific enough that it generated something different every time? That's still an unknown. Like I said, I'm still up at 100,000 feet for you guys, but I'm just talking about all the ideas of what happens. And so what could happen and where it's going to be very important to think about how AI is in the architecture world is, you know, like you said, I have a drawing, but I have no idea that I'm taking from somebody else. What are my risks? That's why you want to inform your client. Part of your designs were created by AI. And here are the potential risks. Do you want me to use AI or not? You know, what you don't want to do is have that building built and the owner gets sued. They don't even know who the architect is. The owner gets sued. They get service. And somebody says, you've infringed on my colonial house that's 2 subdivisions over. And the owner's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then they come back to you and they say, oh yeah, we did it. We used AI. I didn't know it stole from those guys. Like, so part of the thing as an architect when you're working with your clients, I am confident that, I don't know how many people you guys are working now, but when you start working at your company, I am confident that the management, most of the companies you're going to work with, have no idea about the need to inform clients that they're using AI. They're just using it. Everybody's just using it because it's cool and it's fast and it's helpful. It's really helpful. But I have had very few architectural clients ask me to put in language. Actually, I've had none. I tell them, we need to put language into your contract that tells the owner you're using AI so they don't get the knock on the door 2 years from now and then they're mad at you because you didn't tell them. So some of those things, when you go walk in the door with your boss, you can say, hey, I was listening to this guy at class today. He said I should tell you that we need to put something in our contracts about using AI. I'm not suggesting you do that, but it's something to think about. So, And then what's actually being copyrighted, what's being protected, that goes to the same original expression idea. Is it just the computer originally expressing, or is it just the prompt? Last slide. Wait, no, one more after that, sorry. Safeguards, closed systems versus open systems. Company rules and regulations. One of the things that we are doing for our clients, both construction clients, because they're using it for software management and scheduling things, and for the architectural clients, is we are creating rules and regulations. Who can use that? What purposes can you use that for? You want to have, if you're working for a company, you want to have tight restrictions on how AI is being used. Because it's such a wild west, and because we don't know where things are going to go, it's important that the company has guidelines and somebody that's the knowledge manager of what we're using for. So, add your contractual language, and then setting up your systems designed for safeguard of certain information. You don't want your AI going like you could get confidential information from your client, and you feed it into your AI because you're trying to develop something for that, and oops, it was because you needed the way this assembly line went. Well, that then all of a sudden that patented work, that top secret information, it's out there in the world for people to take from. So you have to be careful when you get information from your client as an architect of what may go into your AI prompt and what information is being put in there because it could go out to the system. So those are some of the safeguards that you have to talk to your knowledge managers. Say, how are we keeping our information from going out? I'm worried about information coming in, but how are we keeping ours from going out? It's got to be, the door's got to work, be closed both ways. So this thing's here, balancing of use of AI-generated ideas. On the errors of omission, so remember we talked about your standard of care where the errors of omissions. Standard of care, you have risks of generated errors, hallucinations, for engineering solution, especially in the engineering side, less on the design side, but the engineers are creating something where, like, it's how the engineering actually works, like a machinery or something like that. If there are hallucinations, 27% of the time, one-third of the AIs that are out there generating stuff, one-third of the time, it doesn't exist, it's fake. And that can be troublesome. On the regulatory compliance, so this is on the regulation side when you're building stuff, is the AI complying with building codes, the local requirements? Again, what is required to rein in your hallucinations? And then will the AI be reviewing submittals or drawings and specifications? So like you get in submittals from the shop drawings and from the art contractor, are you giving it to AI to say it's okay? Is that enough? Like those are, again, all these things you want to look at kind of in creating your rules and regulations within the company. And I'm telling you, because it's so new, you guys can be like literally put yourself way ahead when you go to work for your company because there's so much information out there. Just go start reading about it. Not that you have time right now and not that anybody wants to be like, oh, let's spend my weekend reading about AI and stuff. But think about it because when you go work for a company, if you can come in and say, hey, there's these five things that we should do. Maybe it's not the senior person, but maybe it's your project leader. And say, have we talked about this? Because I'm using AI. What do you think about that? That shows initiative. That shows something that you could, the next thing you know, you're going to be put on a task force or a team. Like, that puts you in a good position. And it will make you really beneficial and useful for the company. You'll be a great asset looking at some of the stuff. So, all right. That's it for AI. Any other questions? Like, there's a million questions, a million things on that. But does anybody, I have my other slide deck, which has got a lot more information. There are a couple cases cited in that. Does anybody want me to send that around? I will if you want it. Okay, I'll just send it around. You guys take it with whatever you need for the, it's probably, like, some of these exact things, there's going to be, like, these half a dozen slides, and then there's, you know, probably two dozen more or whatever. You can just take a look at some of the stuff. So, I am not going to spend much time on this at all. You guys all have the agreement. I'm just going to tell you how it works. So, use this part of your slide deck in conjunction with the actual contract. So the actual contract, I don't know if anybody opened up the, because I just sent out this morning, the Word document, you can modify and change it forever what you want. And in the very beginning, there's a little bit that's got red text. That's kind of an instruction thing. So that's what this first part here is. You're going to see what's in blue here, because the red didn't show up on the screen very well, is the same as in your actual document that I sent to Word document. The reason why these slides are going to be beneficial is because it has a lot more things that are in red that gives you instructions on what to do or important elements of the contract. The other thing you're going to see in your contract, there's a half a dozen provisions that have yellow highlighting. That yellow highlighting is because it's a number, like I'm going to charge 8%, or it's a markup of 15%. It's a number that will be modified and changed. Anything that's in yellow highlighting is a financial number that will be negotiated. You know, like, am I getting a markup of 15% or 10% or 5%? Am I charging 8% of the cost of the work or whatever? So those are, what's my hourly rate? Those things are yellowed and highlighted. So that's just for you guys when you're, if you use this contract to build. Again, it's got everything you ever need. It's got every different element. So we have programming. You may not even be doing programming. You have architectural survey. You may not be doing architectural survey. But if you do, these are types of things you can do. So when you go talk to a client and you're going through what you can do for them, think of these. You don't necessarily hand the contract to the client and say, what do you want me to do with these? Make a checklist, a mental checklist or your own checklist when you're talking to the client. Do you want me to do schematic? Do you want me to do estimate and cost schedule? So you start going through these. So some of these we've seen before. We've seen SD. We've seen DD and CD. So some of these are basic, what you've seen in the AIA document, but many, many fewer pages. It's still a lot of pages, but fewer. Bidding and permitting, now it's a much more detailed description than what's in the AIA. So this is just, there's a whole interior design section that we're going to have that you don't see in the B101. So there's just pieces. So you can just cut and paste when you get in projects and working with clients. This talks about higher fees. Obviously, the per hour rates are going to be different. You can do it by percentages for the programming and all these other things. So reimbursable expenses has all that. Additional services, prices for that, changes in project scope, invoice and payment terms, and then your consultants, and then we get into the general conditions. So the first half is the business terms, kind of like how in the AIA documents, the A100s would be. I know the AIA documents for the architecture are the B documents, but if you think about this one, it almost can be split into two, the front section through Article 4, all the way through Article 4, the business terms of your deal. And then through 5, the general conditions are the rules of monopoly between you and the owner of who's doing what. And so you're going to have elements, like I said, these are not highlighted in red in your agreement, but these are going to be ones you want to pay attention to. When you give it to the client, take away the highlighting, of course. But you want to pay attention to some of these elements and say, do I need this, do I not? You can always call me if you have that. I mean, like, if you get a client, you're like, hey, I hung my own shingle and I got a client, I'm using your contract, what do I do about this and this? I'm happy to give you advice. That's not a problem, as I say to all my clients, or my class. And again, it talks about all the things you're going to do, all the elements, and it's like, because it has everything, you don't need all this stuff, but I have a ton of things in here to use for that contract. It will protect you. It will help you make more money because it's got all these things you can provide for the client. And now you have something that whenever, even if you want to go to your boss and say, hey, do we have these in our agreements, that may help out. So that's it. All right? I will see you guys next week at 10 o'clock on Zoom. And then we'll be at the exam. But we'll go over questions. Have your questions ready. And good luck with your work for your final projects.